From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. We hear a lot about how computers have gotten smaller, faster, and cheaper, but what about the insides of computers? Have they changed at all, or did they just shrink? Today we'll talk to John Hennessy and David Patterson. They teach people how to design the computer hardware which we eventually use. I'll also speak with Esther Dyson. She's the publisher of Release 1.0, a monthly newsletter which is subscribed to by everybody who's anybody in the computer industry. Her latest fascination is the emerging technology businesses in Eastern Europe. John Hennessy is the director of the Computer Systems Laboratory at Stanford University. David Patterson is a professor and the former chair of the Computer Science Department at the University of California, Berkeley. Labeled as rivals by the New York Times, they're actually friends who have published their second book on computer architecture. We all accept that the size of a computer has decreased dramatically in the last 20 years. I asked them if the insides of computers had actually changed all that much.
I think that the answer to that is a yes and no answer. If you were to go back and look at the earliest machines built in England right after the war, for example, you'd find a lot of things that are very common. Now, the thing that's changed is the technology that we use to build them. That's changed tremendously. That's why the machines have gotten smaller, that's why they've gotten cheaper, and that's why they've gotten faster. So you wouldn't find a mercury delay line, which is something you would have found in the machines after the war anymore. But you'll find something which performs an equivalent function, albeit with a different technology.
Well, just quickly, let's talk about the primary parts of a computer and what you can change to make the computer run faster.
Well, there's classically five parts of a computer, and this goes back to the 1940s, and that's input, output, the memory, the arithmetic unit, and control. And expect computers 50 years from now will still have those five pieces. To make it go faster, you have to make all the pieces go faster. There's a famous law in computer science that it's kind of the law of diminishing returns, that if you only make one of those pieces go faster, the pieces that you don't make go faster will limit your performance gains. So you need to improve all five pieces to really make computers go faster.
Today, when we're trying to make things go faster, are we just trying to do it in the hardware, or are we also trying to do it in the software?
Oh, what John and I do is make the hardware go faster. The opportunities, though, are equal. There's opportunities to invent great new ideas in software that can make huge differences in performance, factors of hundreds or thousands. What the hardware tends to do is make smaller improvements, but they make improvements for all software.
So when you're changing the hardware, you're just trying to get raw speed or wider data paths or just trying to get the best chassis, if you will. You're not really looking to the software to work with you.
Well, I'd say that's basically true with one important caveat. Namely, what you need to make faster are programs that people really want to use. So you can, as a computer architect, for example, look at what the programs, what's their structure? What do they look like? What do I need to do to make these programs run faster? And some of the ideas that got focused into the RISC concept did exactly that. They said, people don't program in assembly language anymore. They program in high-level languages. And we should build machines which match the needs of compilers and high-level language translators rather than matching the needs of people who are going to write in the machine language.
Well, that's a good... Let's just take off right from there. What is RISC? It's R-I-S-C. What does it mean? What does it do for you?
Well, I should turn this over to Dave since he invented the term.
opportunity for some human interest here.
Someone's famous here. Okay, go ahead.
Where did the term come from? Well, at the time, I was an assistant professor, and one of the main funders of computer science is ARPA, Advanced Research Project Agency, and their mission is to do high-risk, high-payoff research. So we thought naming the project RISC was going to be good for getting ARPA funding. If they fund RISC. But RISC is R-I-S-C, and it stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. And that was actually the name of our project, but it was generalized for a whole class of machines that have become very popular. The basic idea is, smaller is beautiful, is that implement a relatively small set of operations very well. And that's proven to worked surprisingly well over the years.
Well, let me just kind of give my version of this and tell me if I'm right or wrong here. I remember in the 70s, I was working on some CDC equipment, and they had 60-bit words, which are very large words, and they had all these complicated instructions. If you loaded an address in memory in a register, it would automatically pull that data up into the register without having to do a second operation to pull the data up. If you, in other registers, if you put an address in memory, it would take whatever data was there and store it back down. It had any number of instructions for multiplication. It had all of these sort of complicated instructions. And what you're saying is that, hey, we don't really need to do that. We can maybe break that down into a much smaller set of instructions so that if I was the assembly language programmer, I'd have to write more instructions in general. Right?
Yes.
Okay, but now people aren't writing in assembly language so much, so it doesn't matter how many lines of code they're writing. What are they writing in?
The most popular language today is C, but the languages going back to when we were in school, Fortran is still popular in scientific circles. Other languages that people use today are Pascal, Basic, but most people, like the programs that you use when you buy a personal computer, probably just about all of those are written in C today.
Now, there are two books which you've written together. The first is Computer Architecture, a Quantitative Approach. How is that different from this new book?
The first book, what Dave and I were trying to do in the first book, was really to change the way computer architects thought about designing machines and the way people who were being trained, not only in architecture, but in people who are going to write language translators or operating systems, would think about computer architecture. We were trying to get them to think about architecture in a quantitative way. Think about it in almost an engineering scientific fashion, as opposed to thinking about it in a way that's more concerned with aesthetics or abstract principles of the machine. And we really tried to get people to focus on analyzing what they were thinking about. How do you make this machine faster? What affects performance? Those kinds of questions. And that's what really made the first book unique.
John and I wrote that book out of frustration, the way textbooks were being written. The books would tell you, give you a list of alternatives. Here's six different ways to build a cache. But for a student, there was no particular way to figure out when they should use one way or the other, which is here's six ways to do it, a shopping list approach. And we tried to give it a more quantitative foundation, principles that could be applied, numbers that could be calculated to determine what was the right way and the wrong way to do it. And this was a very different way of teaching the material.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are John Hennessy, Director of the Computer Systems Laboratory at Stanford University, and Dave Patterson, Professor of Computer Science at University of California, Berkeley. Now, make no mistake, these books are textbooks, and I appreciated that they can be read by varying people for varying degrees of depth and background. And in your first book, you literally took three different paths for varying depths of understanding. You say you can read these chapters or these sections. Isn't that kind of difficult to write a textbook that way?
I think in some ways it is, but in other ways it can make your life as an author a little easier. I can say, this is advanced material. I am not going to try and bring it down to the level where every single person who might be interested in examining some parts of the book have to understand this more advanced material. And that allows me some flexibility. One of the things that we tried to do in the newer book, which is actually for a more basic audience, a more undergraduate, first level, people who are really trying to learn the basics about computers, is we use these things called elaborations. And they really indicate to the reader, here's something more complicated. And if you don't really want to understand all the details, you can skip this. And in some ways, that makes life a little bit easier for the author, as well as hopefully for the readers, of course.
Well, that's what I like about this. There are so many people who for which computers are fairly new. But there's a lot of people that, even if they are new, they say, gee, I really want to learn more about the inside. And people ask me that all the time, and I say, gee, I don't even know where to begin. They can take a book like this, and they can say, well, I'm going to go to this level, or I'm going to go to this level. And two people can have it at home, and they can each go to different levels at different times, which is really nice. So
I met a person in Washington, and what he said, he figured to talk to a computer, he has to be able to speak to it in its own language. That was his view of what he needed to do. So I sent him a copy of our newer book. If you want to understand if you know a programming language, you understand how machines work, our book's a reasonable place to start if you want to understand how to speak to a machine in its own language.
How did you two get together to write these books? You weren't even at the same university.
And we're not only at the same university, we're arch rivals. We've just played the big game, which Cal happened to just scream, Sandra.
For the first time in 6 years, you know.
Well, that might be true.
They've been gentlemen.
I understand it's because Bill Walsh wasn't feeling well that day. That's the reason.
How much did you pay your coach?
Yeah, he's holding out for a raise, I think. That's why, or he felt pity on Cal. I'm not sure. Neither of us know of any other faculty
who are not speaking
book.
That wrote a book.
Yeah, any other faculty at Stanford and Berkeley who have cooperated in a book. I mean, it's not that often people cooperate from different institutions, but we don't know of other Stanford and Berkeley faculty who've worked yeah. together. Maybe it's happened.
Well, I never invite them both to the same party, so they would have done it.
And we surprised a lot of people with that first book, because not only are Stanford and Berkeley rivals, but for some people, the RISC projects, there were three RISC projects, the founding RISC projects. It was at IBM, Yorktown Heights, the RISC project that John did at Stanford University was called MIPS, and the RISC project at Berkeley. And so many people saw this as rivals. In particular, when a few years later that John founded a company named after his project called MIPS, and then Sun Microsystems started a project called Spark. And so these were, you know, fairly fierce commercial rivals trying to figure out who was going to dominate the RISC marketplace. And there was, you know, very highly competitive, even maybe impolite things were said about about the other companies. And so here we were, in some ways, you know, significant figures in both of these rivals at many different ways. And people found out we were going to write a book, they just assumed we hated each other's guts or something like that.
So actually, it's not true. You don't hate each other's guts.
No. we're the Siskel and Ebert. We get very popular. We just can't stay in the same room. But you know, we get together to write the book, make money by selling them, and then
work like this? Like, I think we ought to only have four small instructions on this risk set. Guy says, "You fool."
No, that'd be more entertaining. That'd be a better story. But actually, I've never met another human being, at least in the technical areas. We don't talk about personal stuff. Well, we just see things the same way, just every single time. And so, actually, what the reaction was, fortunately, even though we were young, aggressive assistant professors, is we saw, you know, somebody on my side to argue against the rest of the industry. So we've been on the same side of the argument for a long time, even though, you know, we kind of won and commercial companies were started. And John and I, you know, talked for several years, but, you know, geez, the textbooks are awful. We're going to have to do something about it. And then what triggered it is I could see I was going to be stuck with the job of department chair at Berkeley. And I knew once I started working as department chair that I wasn't going to get to write the book. And so about a year in advance or so, I told John, look, if we're going to do it, better do it now. And so we sat down and did the book. But we've always been supportive of each other's projects, despite the apparent rivalries.
So you're denying the rumor?
That. Yeah. You should talk to our publishers. We just had an argument today about an opportunity for a book. And John says, the opportunity for writing a book is, you use the language, and we both said simultaneously, visual basic. I mean, right at the same time. Maybe. It's amazing how much we see. So we've decided on interviews like this in the future, we'll just send one of us because we both say the same thing.
Okay. So. Yeah. I think it's interesting, though, because one of the things that's unusual about this book, and about the way both Dave and I think, is that we have not only some academic exposure, but both of us have had some industry experience. And that makes the way you think rather different than if you never have that industry experience. And we've tried to bring some of that out to students, because students, you know, they get educated. They read these textbooks that they think are gospel, and they're not gospel. Of course, they're one person's view. And I think the more experiences you have before you write that book, the better off the material in there is. And I think that's made Dave and I think a lot more alike and focus on different sets of issues than if we purely had the academic background.
Yeah, certainly, especially in computer design, a lot of the action is in industry as well as in the research, and it's been very helpful. And then also, I think John and I probably could have individually done good books, but together we both come up with good ideas, and so I think did a much better book together than we would have done on our own.
Now, see, we've all been through undergraduate and graduate school, and, you know, when you start out, you know, as an undergraduate, and you start to understand all this research is out there and the mighty professors, and this is just all very mysterious. And then you finally get to our age, and you realize, hey, we just make this up. And then we publish it, and sometimes, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's right.
We're lucky it's called good design, you know.
Well, we, you know, John and I took this pretty seriously. We thought, holy smokes, you're going to write a textbook that thousands of people are going to do. This is going to have to be the most important writing we've ever done in our whole life. And we worked really hard. The reaction of others suggests that not every author takes that perspective in writing a textbook, but it's getting it done and out there is the view of some, rather than thousands of minds are going to be shaped.
You know, I've got to ask you this. I read the headline in Monday's business section, and it said, MPP phenomenon destined to change our lives. What are the staff writers at the Chronicle getting so excited about?
we'll talk about this.
I don't know. I think it is the case that the growing amount of computer power continues to have important impact on people. I mean, certainly lots of things we do today we couldn't do if computers hadn't gotten a lot faster and a lot cheaper. And that's going to continue, and I think the big opportunity...
Well, like little things like automatic teller machines.
Yeah, right.
What other examples?
Cellular telephones.
Anti-skid brakes in your cars. The computers in my cars probably saved my new car has probably saved my life a couple of times by stopping without squealing brakes.
This is the big difference between us. Dave likes fast sports cars.
And I see by your bicycle helmet.
Where John knows himself well enough that if he got himself a fast sports car,
I'll get a lot of tickets.
What's MPP?
Yeah, what's MPP? It stands for Massively Parallel Processors. This is what's interesting about this subject, Massively Parallel Processors, is this has been the Eldorado of computer architecture for 30 years. And it's basically what we do today to build faster computers is we spend tens of millions of dollars and maybe 50 or 100 engineers to design the next one, and that's one processor, one chip that does that, and it's faster. But the opportunity, the possibility, is instead of all this effort to design one big next one, why don't we just use many of the current one? And we'll just use 10 of them with the hope of getting 10 times the performance. Or massively usually means 100 or 1,000. So we could have 100 or 1,000 times performance just by taking 100 or 1,000 of the small processors. So that's the dream. The Eldorado is we'll just put a bunch of these small ones together and suddenly we'll get all this performance increase and life will be wonderful. That promise has been true for 30 years. That's what people have been trying to do.
But I think that's my point. I mean, it's been 20 years ago, I was working on the ILIAC, the big, massively parallel.
ILIAC 4?
That was never an ILIAC 1, 2, 3. Or
oh, yeah, there was.
Oh, there was? Did they build those?
Oh, yeah.
All of them ever reached a certain level of operational.
You
read the history section in the back of our books, you'd know that there were more than, yeah, but the 4 was the most famous one.
I knew it. Famous. You ask a textbook writer, he's liable to give you a test. Great.
I think, Dave's this point about parallelism has been the cornerstone or the thing, what I'd say is parallelism has been the thing that we've been after for a long time in computer science. And even by the way, uniprocessors, exploiting parallelism is a key idea that we use to make even single chip processors faster, right? And it's quite fundamental. Now, the good news is that this is a technique that if we really could get our hands around it, it would offer dramatic opportunities for increasing performance. The bad news is that, like Dave said, we've been working on it for 30 or 40 years. It's a hard, hard problem. And I don't know that anything absolutely revolutionary has happened in the last 5 years, although what I would say is that people are starting to get the pieces together. They're starting to have a better understanding of what it takes to exploit these large machines with many processors in them. And that's probably the good news. And as we build up, what we need to do now is kind of push that information down another level. We have to teach students who are still in school about how to think parallel. how to think about writing their programs parallel when they first think about them. And if we can do that and train a new generation of people, I think we can make real progress on this.
To me, there's sort of an arrival time, too, for that kind of an architecture, because it seemed like every time we got a single processor, a uniprocessor, I like that term, I haven't heard that, I've been out of academics for a while, a uniprocessor to go really fast. At the same time, we were saying, let's take that and other architectural techniques and put them in parallel or pipeline them or do something so we can get, since things are going, we're doing many things at once, we're going to get an effective speed up. At the moment we were kind of getting the multiple ones going, there'd be a big breakthrough in how fast or how small the single processor was. So you dump all this multiple stuff, you know, the single processor is now going that fast. So there has to reach some plateau of how fast we're going sort of in a uni sense before, to me, the multiple processing things are really going to pay off.
Well, this is an interesting point. I mean,
Am I an arch rival now?
No. You're partly. I think there's some truth to this.
There are people in the massively parallel industry who have taken that position, which is uniprocessors are going to stop getting fast soon. Therefore, right. You need to switch over massive processors. And they have taken this position for about 25 years. That any day now, uniprocessors are going to run out of steam. So I think that's. That's a dangerous argument, because if you're wrong, if you need processors to get faster, then the corollary is, well, abandon parallelism. But I'd say there's an opportunity there. If we can understand how to exploit parallelism at the level of hundreds and thousands, great, we can leverage both things. And there's also a challenge to the makers of MPP hardware is, can they come up with designs that can quickly track current technology so that there won't be a big time lag between when a workstation comes out, which is the fastest workstation in the world, and that technology is available in MPP with, you know, measured in months rather than years. Right now, unfortunately, that's measured in years, and so the phenomenon that you're talking about of a massively parallel processor getting outdated by a uniprocessor it can still happen.
My guests today are John Hennessy from Stanford University and Dave Patterson from the University of California, Berkeley. Together they have authored several books on the internal architecture of computers. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now I have some future questions. Where do you think computer programming is going, say, 10 to 15 years from now?
In addition to using parallelism, I think the big challenge that all of the computer industry, computer users, researchers all face is how to make programming more effective, how to increase the size of a program that a team of dedicated programmers can really write and ship without increasing the amount of time it takes them to do that. And that's one of the biggest challenges we face. In order to do that, what we have to do is move the level of abstraction up so that, for example, if you think about it, in the old days we wrote, you know, machine language instructions, move this value from this register to this one. Now we write in C, where we say A equals B, and the same thing happens, right? What we need to do is boost that up a level more so that people can write programs. So, for example, if I were to think I have two images on the screen, now what I want to do is move one image to the other. I want to copy parts of the image from one to the other. I want to be able to do that just as easily as 20 years ago. I could, you know, I could make a statement to do that. And instead of having to write a big program to do it, I want to do it in one line. So what we have to do is kind of constantly reinvent that programming process, make it more powerful, and yet, and perhaps not even worry so much about efficiency, because the hardware will get there. We'll make the hardware fast enough, and we'll keep working on that. And if we can find a way to make programmers more effective, that's the key thing we need to look at.
What's interesting is what's happened is this renaissance of processor design. Processors are getting faster each year, faster than they ever have in the history of computers. There's never been an era like this before, and it's enabling, people are trying to figure out what can we do with all this horsepower, and one of the things we can do is basically have less efficient software, because people care more about how long does it take to get these functions to the user rather than how efficiently it uses the hardware, which is a huge change from the way we all learned how to use computers.
Now, data storage and access to data is technologically exploding, but will relevant data really be there to fill it? I mean, computers in your kitchen never really made it. I mean, it was supposed to be really big. It didn't happen. Is there that much data we really want access to?
Do you use libraries?
Well, I do. I go in and I ask that one question, and I get the answer, and I go down and get it off the microfiche.
But this is, I'll start a whole speech here.
Oh, this is your time, Dave.
This is the way libraries, let's talk about universities and libraries today. Right now, if you visit Berkeley, there's a $45 million hole in the ground. It's going to take 4 years, and it's going to hold 2 million books. The information in 2 million books could easily be fit in this studio for a few hundred thousand dollars. And that if we had that information online, that would be so much easier. Today, to get a book out, you have to walk to the library. When you take that book out, you're the only one who gets access to the information until you return the book. It costs the library more than a dollar every time you put a book there. Librarians have to buy books in anticipation of need rather than on demand, so about 20% of all the books they buy, no one ever checks out. So we have an incredibly inefficient system today of the way we try and do scholarship, those who go to the library. There's no technological reason next year that we couldn't have all of the information in the Library of Congress at our fingertips, so that what's kind of ironic today is you can search for a book using computers to find out if the book's in the library. But you can't get the information that's corresponding to that book without walking down the library. That information could be at your fingertips technologically. The challenge is, in my view, is non-technological, because as technologists, these are the type of problems we do really well at. But the copyright laws and the business model, so that publishers will feel comfortable putting books online, especially our publisher.
Well, that's my question. I mean, here we are. We're talking about this great new book, Computer Organization and Design, the Hardware-Software Interface. Every time somebody wants to read it, they buy your book. Now, are you comfortable with them not buying your book, but you just put it online and everybody can have access to it?
That's the economic portion of the question. I think there's a return on investment issue that you need to solve here. But I think...
There we go.
Yeah. And clearly you need to solve that. But the opportunity here is so large. I don't know how many of the listeners out there have ever tried to use, for example, one of these encyclopedias on a CD-ROM.
Oh.
But if your kids dread using an encyclopedia, you should go out and buy one of these things in a minute. My 7-year-old can pick it up and can read an article and follow it through and follow hot links in it. Now, you can imagine if I also had attached to my machine a link down to the Berkeley Library that was all online, the way Dave's described. Now, for example, I get to the end of the article and I want to know more. Well, now I can use my modem, connect up to the Berkeley Library, and get a whole book on the topic, not just the encyclopedia reference. And I think these kinds of things, bringing them into the education system and getting people, make the information not only more available, but easier to use, more attractive. I think that would be a big step.
And you know, we live in a capitalist society. This is not government-funded, so we need to get people to spend money to make this information available. All we need is a mechanism to return money to the people who invested it. And you know, this is not an unsolved problem. The music industry, right, works this way. If we didn't have the person who writes songs gets money every time it gets played on the radio. So we just need to
every time your book is read.
Yeah, that'd be if
you
we
get
did
an
it on
ankle.
Use. We John and I think people really actually do buy our book and read it, not just prop doors open. So I think we'd be pretty interested in a pay for use. I think we would do pretty well out of that. But we have to have the business model in place and a way to collect money and all of that, as well as having electronic access. So that there's an opportunity for listeners out there to figure out what to do about copyright laws and to create the demand for electronic access for information and a fair way to pay for that.
What will happen is creating the information will be the costly thing. It won't be storing it anymore. That will get very cheap. It's creating it. So you have to, just like with music people, it's not recording. It's not the recording technology of a CD that you pay when you go to the music store. You're paying for somebody to create that music. And that's what you have to get in place.
John, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guests today have been John Hennessy, Director of the Computer Systems Laboratory at Stanford University, and Dave Patterson, Professor of Computer Science at the University of California, Berkeley. Their new book, Computer Organization and Design, the Hardware-Software Interface, is published by Morgan Kaufman. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Esther Dyson is the president of Adventure Holding and publisher of the Release 1.0 monthly newsletter. A recent article in Wired magazine suggests that she is arguably the most powerful woman in computing today. Speaking with her in her office in New York City, I asked her to comment on that statement.
There are so few women in computing.
So one of us has to be?
Yeah. Well, I'm one of the people who notices things early and helps to push smart ideas and people and companies into the forefront. I don't create them, but I help them get noticed, and then it's up to them. And contrary to what a lot of people have said, I also don't destroy them. I just kind of move things along a little.
So you see the trends early.
Yeah. What I like doing is figuring things out that other people don't yet understand, finding new companies that people haven't yet noticed, or in the case of Released, finding new countries that people don't pay much attention to yet.
Now, you've got two newsletters, Release 1.0 and Released. Why don't you tell us what those do?
Okay. Well, Release 1.0 I acquired from its founder in 1982. He was Ben Rosen, and he was writing this newsletter. He also invested some money in two little startups. And that would have been great, except one was Compaq and the other was Lotus. So he had a slight conflict of interest problem. And he hired me to write the newsletter, and the thinking was, great, I'll write it, and his conflict problem will go away. But everybody said, oh, Ben hired this girl to do his job, but she's basically saying what he tells her to. So it didn't work. And in 1983, I ended up buying the newsletter. I changed its name from Rosen Electronics Letter, which was REL, to Release 1.0, which includes those three letters, and took it forward from there. It started out as being fairly on the commercial side and looking at what the mainstream was doing, things such as Compaq and Lotus. But as those became better covered and not as... everybody kind of knew what was going on. I moved off into the ozone, some people think, and I covered things like electronic distribution of software, where I was way early, and artificial intelligence and client server and stuff like that. And now I do... my slogan is vaporware and proud of it. So I do things like performance support and lots of terms you haven't heard, or lots of terms people know but they don't really know what they are. So I try and figure out whether they're real and what the concepts are and how much they make sense. I'm not a big fan of multimedia, but I think it needs explaining. Hypertext, networking, the internet, network-based communities. I just did an issue on the idea of explicitness, which, well, in order to design a software system, you need to be explicit, and you need to say who is doing what and who owes what, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with explicitness. Explicitness is a prenuptial contract, but people would like to be in love, and they don't want to deal with that, and so there are interesting social dynamics to do with explicitness, and I looked at those in the context of designing software, and especially groupware, which is software about people interacting.
Now, you've described the issues you talk about in Release 1.0. What about RHEL East?
RHEL East is completely different. I went to Russia for the first time in April of 89, and I had always wanted to go because I speak Russian, but I didn't want to go as a tourist, and I got invited as part of a three-person delegation, which was me, Gary Chapman from Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, which is exactly what it sounds like, a sort of do-good group on the towards the left, and Sherry Turkle, who wrote the book The Second Self about children and computers and is a psychologist. And none of us was a businessman, it's clear. So we went over at the invitation of the International Computer Club, which is really a Russian or a Soviet sort of trade organization of users. It wasn't a club in any sense we'd mean it. And while we were there, there was also a delegation of real live German businessmen. So they left us completely to ourselves. And we roamed around Moscow and we met programmers and had a ball, and it was great. I went back to the U.S. and I told people stories about what it was like, which was basically, the whole country is dysfunctional. And there were very funny stories about how things didn't work, and people would spend half an hour arguing in the cold about who would sit in which seat of two cars, seven people, two cars with four seats each, and we argued for half an hour. So I would tell these stories, and I thought I was lying, because I didn't believe them. They sounded too preposterous. Anyway, I went back about three times and realized I had fallen in love. So eventually I started a second newsletter, because the people who wanted to read about objects and AI and software design complained that they didn't want to read about Russians and Hungarians. And so I started Rel East to write about that whole commercial, technically fairly mundane, but socially and commercially extremely interesting set of markets in Eastern Europe.
Actually, when you think about it, we've just, in the United States and in Western Europe, been marching forward on this drumbeat for 20, 30 years of technology and developing markets and developing engineers and sales and all of that and selling internationally. And, I mean, they're creating the socioeconomic infrastructure at the same time they're trying to create the technology themselves.
Well, I sort of divide it into three parts. There's Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovenia, and they're kind of like the good kids. They have a few problems, but basically they're moving forward. They're going to become pretty Western pretty quickly. They have normal concepts of running businesses, even though a fair amount is still owned by the government. It's basically, they're normal. They have normal markets. And they're adopting the technology very quickly. Then they're the leftover countries, which they're left over by the rest of the world, not by themselves. Places like Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and the small markets like the Baltics, which people just don't pay enough attention to. And they have fairly severe problems, but they're small, and I think they'll solve them. And then there's Russia, which is a huge potential market and has gotten a lot of interest, but it has huge problems. And in one sense, what's interesting is they're ahead of us in the sense that they're already providing value added. They've already come to the conclusion that technology, that most hardware per se, is commodities. And so the businesses are value adding businesses. They're doing software, they're installing systems, what have you. And they're not downsizing because there's nothing to downsize from. So in certain ways of using the technology, they're fairly advanced. The business culture is primitive. And the issue isn't capitalism or, in other words, trying to make a profit and knowing how to trade. The issue is business culture, things like knowing that you should answer the telephone, knowing how to be a good manager, little things like every time you send a letter, make sure your phone number is at the bottom so they can get back in touch with you. We sent out questionnaires to all the people who came to our conference with who are you, what were your revenues, what kind of products are you looking for, what kind of partners do you need, the goal being that we would publish this and people could find each other. And it's very depressing. We've gotten answers from most of the Western companies, and very few have come back from the Eastern companies. And this morning I got a letter from one of the Eastern companies, and it was a very nice letter, and it said, we started a new business because the one we had kind of collapsed, and we're selling Unix and TCP/IP, but it didn't answer any of the other questions. And so the guy's a capitalist. He wants to make money. He knows he is trying to make a profit. He owns his company. But he doesn't have that business culture.
So he doesn't know some of the things that we would know today, such as, well, you need to have an 800 number, and you need to get a Visa, MasterCard merchant account, and you need to get...
Those things, those things are fairly technical, but even more basic things, like being responsive to questions. And so capitalism may be part of an instinct, but the business culture is learned, and that's the most difficult part.
Who's been subscribing to Rel East?
a pitifully small number of people. It's somewhere around 70. And then a lot of people in the East get it for free. And they are primarily computer companies interested in doing business in Eastern Europe already active there. So it's Microsoft, Oracle, Compaq, people like that, some consultants. And some of the Easterners are now paying as well. Because despite what I said, there's also a cadre of very advanced, savvy companies who are progressing extremely rapidly, and that's fun to watch.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Esther Dyson, president of Adventure Holdings and editor of Rail East, a newsletter about emerging computer companies and markets in Eastern Europe. Now, Release 1.0, that has far more subscribers.
Yes, it has about 1,300 subscribers, and there we certainly have some Europeans, and we have Singapore and I think Oman and a few other places. But fundamentally, it's U.S. people. They tend to be the presidents of the smaller firms and the presidents and the techie strategic people or the marketing people in the larger firms. They're people, what Release 1.0, it doesn't tell you what product to buy. It tells you what company to buy or what product line to invest in, where the industry is going. If a normal newsletter does product reviews, this is more like literary criticism. And it tries to explain the dynamics or the structure of the industry or the goal or purpose of a product rather than just describe it or say what it does or whether it's good. In fact, I don't really care whether it works as much as I care what it's trying to do, because I'm more interested in products as models than as it's $79.95 and you can buy it at Egghead or whatever.
Where do you get your ideas for the newsletter?
I get my ideas in all kinds of weird ways. I talk to lots and lots of smart people, and I notice things that come by. You sort of get sensitized to them. You hear a word two times, another smart guy mentions it, and you say, that's something I don't know about, and I'd like to know more, and then you start investigating. Also, I do interesting stuff. I went to visit the CIA last April. I went to a meeting on yield management, which is the art of how you price airline tickets. And this was a couple of years ago. The airline guys were just ready to pass on their knowledge to the hotel people and the car rental people. And it was fascinating. I mean, partly for me as somebody who flies almost every other day, it was like going to a strategy session of the enemy. But it's also intellectually fascinating how they do this, because there's all kinds of factors you put in, and what you're trying to do basically segment your market. The people who are willing to pay more, you want them to pay more, but you also want to catch the people who are very cost sensitive and get them as well. So I go to things like the Yield Management Conference. I'm on the boards of advisors of a number of organizations, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Santa Fe Institute, which does complex adaptive systems, the Global Business Network, which advises people like Shell and Bell South. I'm on the board of advisors of Poynter Institute, which does strategy research for the newspaper and broadcasting industries. And all these things kind of combine and give me interesting ideas.
I was looking at a June 1991 Release 1.0, and you wrote, "We trade our subscriber list to people we approve of." What kinds of people do you approve of?
Oh, mostly other newsletter publishers. We certainly don't sell it to people who are trying to sell wine or porn videos or anything like that. And the important thing is that's a personal decision. That's not censorship. And this is a very interesting issue because I'm not acting in loco the government. I'm acting as myself. And the way the world works now, we have an implicit contract with our subscribers that we own their names and that we're nice people and we won't do bad things with them. I'd much rather see a world where there was an explicit contract But right now, the convention is that you are free to sell your list. We don't, in fact, sell it. We just trade it, and we trade it to people we like. But we could abuse that. And then our subscribers would complain, and we'd do something about it. And that's the nice old-fashioned world where people don't take license. But we're rapidly heading towards a world where everything is bought and sold, and people find that unpleasant with reason.
Well, you talked about in a letter, a newsletter right around that time, about how it might get to the point where information about yourself was yours, and so even if you subscribed to a newsletter, that was only for that purpose, and that you could, in fact, expect to sell that information to whoever might be interested, that you yourself would receive that money. Talk a little about that.
People are starting, everything is for sale. So if everything is for sale, I'd rather have the people who generate the data, the individuals, own it instead of having the people who collect it own it. And if you just made that little change, instead of having all kinds of government regulations about what was okay and what wasn't okay and worried about censorship and free speech and so forth, if the government just said, the information about you that you generate is your own, then people would have the right to sell it. And you're sitting here thinking, well, that's incredibly complicated. I'm going to sell it for 5 cents to the ketchup guy and for 29 cents. But the way it actually works is very much the way, for example, frequent flyer miles work. There are now companies that are offering the service of helping you manage your frequent flyer miles. Imagine how fast you get Fred's Data Boutique and you get the First Industrial Data Bank, very serious, and you get the, you know, the Farmers Credit and Data Union or what have you. All these different organizations would show up to help individuals manage their data. Mm-hmm. But their allegiance would be to the individuals instead of being to the mailing houses the way it is now. They'd be managing fundamentally the same data, but they'd have a fiduciary responsibility to the individuals instead of to American Express or catalog houses or what have you. And so the economics in the market would work in favor of people protecting the integrity of their data.
My guest today is Esther Dyson, editor of the newsletter Release 1.0 about emerging technologies. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Just quickly, I'll name some things, and you tell me just a hit on your reaction to them. What do you think of virtual reality?
I think it's a great idea, but way oversold. The very short answer is, virtual reality is a very nice idea, but people also need symbols as well as just models and pictures and the ability to operate in space. For example, I might want to say, take every red ball and raise it 2 feet. That's a lot quicker than pointing to all the red balls, which is what I do in virtual reality. So you want the ability to work symbolically as well as by direct manipulation.
What about multimedia?
Multimedia, also cool stuff. Again, oversold. It makes great demos. People can understand it. It's exciting. But as a business, first, there's going to be a shortage of people who can create good multimedia. And second, the real applications are going to be training, presentations, sales. Mind you, those are large areas, but it's not... Again, people want symbols. They want spreadsheets as well as talking graphs that move.
What about artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence is such a broad area, you can't really talk about it in general. But the techniques it includes, which are expert systems and various kinds of search and rules, are all extremely valuable techniques. Frequently, they vanish into applications. Once they're being used and they work, people don't call it AI anymore.
You've been repeatedly described as a visionary. Have you ever been wrong?
I've been over-optimistic. For example, about AI, I think I was... It wasn't that I was wrong technically, but I was a lot more optimistic. Things didn't happen as smoothly or as easily. I've been too optimistic. The polite way of saying is I'm early. I'm trying to think of something I was enthusiastic about that really flopped. For example, American Information Exchange is a company that works on the notion of buying and selling information over the electronic network. It was partly owned by Autodesk, which eventually just kind of let it free, which is a polite way of saying dumped it last year. And I still think the idea is really cool, and I think it will happen, but the company itself has had a much more troubled time than I expected. You know, when something's a great idea, I think it ought to work, and sometimes it doesn't.
What is it that excites you? Is it the technology, or assimilating and analyzing the trends, or talking to people? What is it that excites you about all this?
What excites me really is figuring things out, and I like to figure out new things. I don't like to be redundant. If someone else has already written something or done something, I don't see any point in trying to do it too. I like discovering stuff, and I like discovering people. I like putting people in touch with each other, sort of just giving things a little shove so that they get noticed or combined. Or, on the other hand, I'm very lazy. I don't like to do the work. I like to put things together so that they can do the work.
I guess that really then works with both newsletters. Release 1.0 has the PC Forum here in the United States each year, only open to subscribers, and Rel East has, is it the East-West?
High-Tech Forum
in Eastern Europe. Is that where you bring those people together?
Well, I certainly do it at those conferences, but I also do it throughout the year by making phone calls, and sometimes you have to really browbeat people. Did you remember to call him? You know, you would really enjoy it if you talked to him, and so forth. And eventually they do. Two people who met at East-West High-Tech Forum got married last June. So we don't do just business arrangements. For example, I persuaded Mort Meyerson, who's the chairman of Perot Systems, on which I'm also on the board of advisors, to come and spend a weekend in Prague with about 7 entrepreneurs from Eastern Europe. So I do this all the time because it's fun to do, and then I do it for real and for money twice each year with these two conferences.
What are you writing about now?
One thing I'm trying to sort out now is the role the government should be taking in the open platform, in this whole convergence and confluence of computer companies, cable companies, telephone companies, even utilities. My initial feeling is, well, I just like the free market to rule and everything would be great. But the free market didn't rule, and so it's hard to get from here to there. There are problems of past and existing regulations and unfairnesses. So you want a level playing field, you want it well lighted, and you want to make sure that everybody goes on there with some kind of fair allocation of equipment. On the other hand, a company that got to be large fairly is not inherently a mean, nasty company. So I'm trying to figure out what I think about all this, and that'll make a great issue.
Where's Release 1.0 heading now?
Well, for years, people have come up to me and said, so when are you going to do Release 2.0, yuck, yuck, yuck? So I feel it's about Release 10.0 of that particular joke. But I'm actually now thinking about Release 2.0, which would be online. And the notion is I'd publish something like about Release 0.8, or not quite finished, but not a total draft, and collect feedback from people. I already do that mostly by fax, sometimes by email now. It's a manual process. I think of a particular individual, I send him a draft, and in particular I send drafts to the people I write about, and then I collect it and kind of incorporate it into Release 1.0. The notion here is more I'd put it out on the network, and the subscribers, all of them would be invited to contribute. Of course, not all of them would, but more I wouldn't have to think of each individual person to send it to. And then I'd incorporate those comments or remarks or, you know, indications or digressions or whatever into release 2.0, which would not be release 1.0 is fundamentally written by me and I collect the contributions. Release 2.0 would be more visibly a group effort. It would be edited or moderated, if you want to use the online term. But it would be clear that Philippe Kahn had contributed this thought, or here was David Liddell's fix on that, or
it's almost like an international forum.
Well, like a compendium, a back and forth discussion, but edited and pulled together and made coherent, but where the individual contributions were still visible.
What do you think you'll be doing, or what do you want to do, say 5 to 8 years from now?
I expect to still be uncovering new stuff and making new things happen. I'm not sure precisely in what milieu, because I expect, for example, that Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic will be completely grown up by then. But new things keep happening.
I know you've been in the trend analysis side of technology. Have you ever done any design or development of technology?
No. I got into this by spending 3 years at Forbes as a reporter and 5 years on Wall Street following high-tech companies. I started with Cray Research, Tandem, and Federal Express, which kind of gave me a certain vision of what a cute small company should be like and what potential it should have. Where I get my techie stuff is more that my parents were both scientists, so I feel comfortable with it. But precisely in order to avoid competing with them, I decided I'd go off and do business, and then I ended up here.
Now, this sort of brings us to the Internet, and more people are excited about it. And I've just been amazed at how many people. I met a man the other day who was 74 years old. He's on the Internet every day. And how do you see the Internet and all the systems that are just a global international communications network? What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, this is interesting because Release 2.0 is precisely to manage this problem of, no, I don't want to spend all my time on the Internet filtering all this junk. I want someone to filter it for me, not by doing a text search routine, but by actually making it coherent, because a lot of what comes over the Internet may be coherent in individual chunks, but there's too much of it, it's redundant, and some of it isn't very good. So there's still going to be a role for brand name editors, moderators, assemblers, people who take a lot of that stuff and refine it down, not just by selecting it, but actually by reassembling it. In general, obviously, I think the Internet is wonderful and amazing. And what I like about it is it's not an it. It's a collection. It's not homogeneous. And so the Internet is very inclusive. And that means it's kind of like normal life. There's a lot of junk in it and a lot of truly wonderful things. And like artificial intelligence and like motherhood, you can't really say that good or bad in the abstract. It's good that it exists. But you can't say anything very meaningful until you talk about particular things on it.
Esther, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. That was great.
Esther Dyson is president of Adventure Holdings and editor of the Release 1.0 newsletter. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for TechNation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.